It's been 10 years since the peak of the migration crisis in Europe. January 2016 set a grim record for the number of migrants dying while attempting to cross the Mediterranean after more than 1.2 million people came to Europe seeking protection in the previous 12 months. As recently as December, the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen was claiming a measure of success on this issue when she said that Europe is now managing migration responsibly. But what does a responsible migration policy look like, and what impacts do the events of 2015 and 2016 have on Europe today? It's News Talk Daily. I'm Tara Duggan. Now, we all remember vividly the harrowing images of what was happening, particularly around Greek islands and in Turkey and the Balkans, being beamed onto our TV sets and phones every day. Perhaps most emblematic of the human tragedy was the infamous photo of the body of two-year-old Alan Kurdi washed up on a Turkish beach. 10 years on, things have certainly changed in Europe and in terms of the number of people travelling illegally to the continent for the better. According to the EU, at least. Its border agency, Frontex, says 178,000 people arrived in Europe by irregular means last year, which was a drop of a third on 2024, and half the amount that arrived in 2023. New asylum applications also decreased by about 26% in the first 9 months of last year. The president of the European Commission has said that figures speak for themselves and that every smuggling trip avoided is potentially a life saver. She points to the partnerships that the EU is building with other countries to curb migration and to fight people smuggling as a key aspect of European policy. But how are the EU's partners preventing border crossings? What impact does it have on those attempting to come here now? And what has been the broader impact on the continent of the events of 10 years ago? Joining me today to discuss this are journalist Valerie Cox, who volunteered on the Greek islands at the height of the crisis, and host of the Fortress Europe podcast, Andrew Connolly. We'll also be hearing from spokesperson for Frontex, Chris Borowski, who we spoke with a little earlier. Valerie and Andrew, you're very welcome to News Talk Daily today.
Thank you.
Valerie, I'm going to start with you. Tell me about your involvement at the time, your travels to the Greek islands, what sparked them and how they were.
Well, it was September 2015, and I think Europe was really just wakening up at that stage to what was really happening. And as you said, finding little Alan Kurdi's body on the beach, you know, it covered news front page newspapers globally, all over the world. Yep. So my husband and I were having dinner and a glass of wine, as you do, and we were giving out about Europe and how they'd done so little. And we were due to go on holidays a few days later, and I said, God, you feel like trying to do something yourself. And Brian, who's very spontaneous, said, OK, we'll go out there. So a couple of days later, we got a flight out to the island of Kos. Now, you've to understand all of these islands, you've got Kos, you've got Chios, Lesbos, Leros, and it's only a distance of 6 kilometres from those islands to the Turkish coast, which is where the traffickers bring all of these people. So it's only 6 kilometres, but it is a shipping lane. So it's very dangerous and very deep. And they come across in these huge rubber dinghies. Some of them will take up to 70 people. Mm. Absolutely enormous. And very, very heavy weights, because all their luggage has been thrown overboard by the traffickers. So Brian and I just looked it up, said, right, Kos looks as if it needs some help. And we flew out to Kos and just walked down to the beach.
And you didn't make any arrangements in advance? You hadn't reached out to any NGOs who were operating in the area? You just literally turned up?
We did, because at that stage, you see, the NGOs hadn't really moved in. The local Red Cross organisations were doing something, but in the main, at that stage, when we turned up, we found 2 and 3 people coming together from all over Europe. We met a number of retired midwives who went out to help. And when you got there, it was actually, the volume of it, the extent of the problem was much bigger than I'd ever expected, because you had whole beaches covered with people. Some of them had tents, some didn't. Little tents like you'd buy in a supermarket, that sort of thing. And they were hungry. They had no personal effects, because the traffickers get them into the boat in Turkey and then throw all their cases overboard. So you had people coming in without shoes, without much in the way of clothes, and always hungry. So we started meeting up with other people on the beaches who had come out for the same reasons as ourselves. Now, when we were going out, my colleagues colleagues and a few other people gave us some money. We didn't. We had about €10,000 going out. And that €10,000 went further than I've ever seen a euro go. There was a very cheap Chinese supermarket on the island, and we were able to buy shoes, good runners for about €17. We were able to stock up with food. It was absolutely amazing. Now, at that stage, the only NGO operating was Médecins Sans Frontières. And since then, I've been watching them so closely. They are the most amazing organisation. They don't listen to red tape. They don't listen to bureaucracy. At one stage, they were trying to salvage their tourism industry on the island, which is understandable. And the mayor banned all sorts of things, like when people came in at night, the taxi men weren't allowed to take them to the towns, because if they did, they lost their licence. It was very, very difficult.
Okay.
So we started, everybody got together and we decided on what we'd do. Two Irish Gardaí came out shortly after us, and they took a disused restaurant and provided breakfast and dinner every day for the refugees. So you had this enormous input from just people acting off their own bat. So we used to sit on the beaches at night time, and they're not the nice sandy beaches that you'd associate with Greek islands.
Greek island,
they're,
yeah.
These gravelly on costs and very difficult to walk on, actually. But you'd sit there in the dark, and you know that lovely Mediterranean night sky with the stars, but you couldn't turn on any lights because the Coast Guard from Turkey were out picking up any boats they found and bringing them back to Turkey. So you sat there and it was so quiet, and you could hear the voices eventually as they got near the shore. And then you just gave a single flash of a torch so they knew where they were to head for. And then they'd come in, you'd get them in out of that area. But I mean, that area close to shore, 10 feet, it was so dangerous. And that's where so many people drowned. So you'd get them in over that and then tell them where they had to walk to register. And for some reason, the mayor was making it so difficult, they had to register at 4 a.m. and they had to walk 4 miles into the town to do that. And the difficulties, I mean, these people had been on the road for months and months. They were not in the whole of their health by any means. They were exhausted. They had no, well, most of them didn't have proper shoes even. So it was an absolute nightmare for them.
And it's clear from what you're saying, the mayor of Kos was not happy that this was happening on their doorstep. And, you know, I mean, understandably, the island relies on tourism for its local economy. But how were the locals on Kos outside of the officials? Were they welcoming to the people who were arriving on their shores morning, noon and night?
The locals were wonderful. And you've got to remember, this was the beginning of the crisis, so they weren't hardened by it or anything. There were a number of expats who got together and ran fantastic operations. But the local women on the island were unbelievable. For example, there were only 3 loos, port-a-loos, in the port. That's all they had. And to let the women go in, the old ladies used to come out and they'd offer to mind their children for them while they queued and while they went in. For the men, there was 1 cold hose pipe in the port, and that's how they were able to shower. There was a local woman there who actually started an organisation as a result. And while we were there the first time, we went out 3 times, but the first time we were there, in the middle of it all, a container actually arrived from Northern Ireland, stuffed with clothes and stuffed with GAA jerseys from all over Ireland. We just couldn't believe it. So, I mean, that getting that facility was wonderful. And on the other islands, the same thing. Now, we didn't go out to the other islands on that occasion, but later we did. And, you know, you were so grateful for what people were sending out and for the organisation that the locals brought to it. On the island of Chios, the locals got together and they rented a warehouse. And they were able to sort the clothes and manage to distribute them because the numbers were getting very, very high. You know, you weren't talking about dozens, you were talking about thousands of people.
And where was officialdom in all of this?
Well, it's very hard to tell. I mean, there is, some NGOs came out. The Shepherd's Purse came out and they were absolutely wonderful. They worked mainly on Leros. And on Leros, what happened there was, it's a very tiny island, but the Coast Guard started bringing people ashore in Leros. And there was nowhere to live, so they took over an abandoned abattoir. Now, there hadn't been animals in it for ages, but the bottom floor of that had concrete floors, and that became the maternity hospital for the area. Women went there and gave birth on the floors. And luckily, we had a few volunteer midwives who went out there and helped with that. But that was what Liros was doing. But the other islands had started having the refugee camps. They were beginning to spring up. And to be honest, they were very, very badly managed, because locals and people from slightly further afield, but Greek people mainly, they were paid to provide food. And the food was appalling, and people were hungry. When we were out, the following time we went out, we were on the island of Chios, which is also very small and very little in the way of facilities. I mean, there isn't a proper hospital or anything. Yeah. And they were getting, you know, a Chinese takeaway. Well, they were getting about a third of that with rice, a little bit of sauce, a large bread roll, and a bottle of water every day. So we were involved in a feeding program there with the locals, and we managed to give work, the bakers were all off work because there were no tourists. So we got the bakers to make protein cakes. We got milk every day and fruit. So everybody in the refugee camps got milk and bread and a protein cake. And it made such a difference, especially to the children.
Yeah, of course. And what is your awareness now, Valerie? We're hearing 10 years on from this that Europe is heralding a success in the management and talking about those numbers and how they have reduced. What's your experience now, if any, of what the situation is in the ground in islands like that?
Yeah.
Migrants are still turning up, clearly.
Absolutely. I don't think this is a success. I don't think it's remotely a success. There's about 160,000 people still on these small islands. And they are small. I mean, this is an enormous implosion for these people. And it's not being handled very well. You know, we've turned from being humanitarian and saying what is best for these people to being suspicious of them and trying to push them back. And we've got all these deals they've done with very strange places like Mauritania and, you know, Tunisia, places that you wouldn't normally be doing deals with. And the only thing there is to keep people back. Now, I know, you know, you can't let millions come in. It has to be processed in some manner, some form. But I don't think it's being done in a very humanitarian way. I think we've turned into a very cruel people in Europe. We've brought in a lot of sensible regulations, I think, about making people who get here, in Ireland's case anyway, and in a number of others, you know, making them wait for citizenship and so on. And that's all fine. That's normal processing. But this thing of pushing people back at borders and forcing them into these big refugee camps and in dreadful places. Now, you know, I have to say there's a very good side to it too. Maybe not coming from authorities so much as from individuals. There's a woman from Waterford who went out to Bodrum, realised these people were being holed up there for years, really, a couple of years anyway. And she started a school, and she's got a wonderful school going for the last few years. And the kids who are holed up there are going to the school. She's got women learning trades. She's feeding them. So, you know, that's a counterpoint.
Yeah. And I suppose that's something that we don't think of. We think of maybe the people who do manage to land, in inverted commas, safely, and feeding them and clothing them. But those basic rights of education and schooling, there's just a big black hole.
They're just gone, really, to a large extent. And for the people who are coming in as well, they are very traumatised. I mean, when we were on Kos the first time, there were a lot of drownings. And I remember one morning, Brian and I went to 14 funerals.
My goodness.
And those people had no names. There was no ID. There were a couple of young women in it. There were children. And people speculated that maybe these were the children of these women. We'll never know. But the island people got together and they gave land to build a little graveyard, especially for the refugees who had no names.
I want to bring in Andrew in a moment. Valerie, that's very powerful what you've been telling us there. But first of all, I want to hear from Chris Borowski from Frontex. We spoke to him a little earlier. We asked him if these numbers could be characterised, in his opinion and in Frontex's opinion, as a success.
Well, first, I think it is important to say that we have to respect people's dignity wherever we work, wherever, you know, we are dealing with the borders. And I think it's important that we bring this standard to countries outside of the EU. I don't think that walking away from the problem is the solution. I think that cooperation is key. Cooperation with expectations, cooperation with standards that we expect from our partners. It's also essential to work with countries outside of the EU. Once people reach the sea and go on this dangerous journey that often ends in death, that is almost too late for us. So we really need to work with countries outside of the European Union, outside of Europe. It is true that once you put some pressure on a specific area, and we have seen this time and time again, when we would work with the country, they would go after these criminal gangs that are profiting from the desperation of people, and really clamp down against these groups, then these are businesses that look for other opportunities. They will go somewhere else. They will try to find different routes. This is one of the benefits of having Frontex, this European Border and Coast Guard Agency, that is able to provide additional support to countries that come under pressure. And we've had, migration is not a tap you can just turn off. It is a very complex situation where a lot of factors have an effect on this. Will this mean it's, you know, disappearance of criminal groups? Absolutely not. Criminal groups make millions and millions and millions of euros every year from the desperation of the people that want to come to Europe. They will look for places where they could use the political instability, and other factors to be able to continue their business. And it is our business as border guards, as law enforcement, to go after these criminal groups to make sure that they do not abuse the people that they bring to Europe, that we find legal channels for them to come to Europe, to make sure that not only that we prevent these criminal groups from profiting, but also we make sure that the people coming here do not put their lives in danger.
Andrew Connolly, you're the host of Fortress Europe podcast. Tell me a little about your involvement with this subject and about the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me. I've been covering the refugee crisis since it first became known under that term, since around sort of 2015. I also went to the Greek islands, but I also went up and down the so-called Balkan route, which is effectively where people were passing for one or two years when the borders were relatively open. So people would in general go from Turkey to the Greek islands, up through the Balkans, and then onwards to Northern Europe, mainly Germany, Sweden, and so on. And I would visit all the countries in between and outside, just to try and get a sense of who these people were, why were they coming, what were they leaving behind, where were they going to, and what was happening on their journeys. And it's interesting to look back 10 years on, because for a brief time, there was effectively, although a bit of a problematic one, but a humanitarian corridor of sorts, in that, yes, you did have to get a boat from Turkey to Greece, and that did result in drownings. Many people made that crossing, though, and survived. More than 1 million people came through in a year. And this was before Europe was able to militarize most of the borders as they have done now. So you were actually able to follow people through their journey and talk to them and get an idea about who they were. And you were able to report them as three-dimensional characters, not quite the sort of anonymous blob that we often see. Now, my involvement carried on for many years because I saw the policies changing quite quickly. Though there was a big amount of sympathy at the time in 2015, you've mentioned Alan Kurdi on the shore. I also saw lots of sympathy on the ground from the locals. For example, on the island of Lesbos, many people are themselves descendants of refugees who were forced out from Turkey. One man told me that he was very against the refugees coming, but then he looked at the boats, he saw an old woman, and he thought, well, that could have been my grandmother a century ago. And likewise, in the Balkans, you had situations where migrants were stopped on the border in front of some sort of crude rolls of barbed wire that had been erected by border authorities. And you had journalists from the region, from Bosnia, for example, breaking down and crying because it reminded them of their situation during the conflict of the 90s. So Europe has been the scene of, you know, big movements of refugees for a long time. But at the time in 2015, you could connect that with what was happening back in the countries of origin, like Syria and Afghanistan and Iraq, because there was media coverage of the wars and persecution at the time. And so in general, there was a bit more understanding about why these people were making the journey. But very quickly, even after then-Chancellor Angela Merkel said that we could accept all these people into Germany, she also started to try and shut down the borders of Europe too. And that's been happening ever since. And I've been tracking the ways in which this is done, and almost exclusively it's done in quite a violent way at great cost to the migrants and refugees who are crossing. It's characterized by the most grotesque kind of human rights abuses, both by European border guards and client states in North Africa and the Middle East. And it has not in any way made the situation go away. In fact, it's become more radicalized, the discourse around it more and more shrill. And yet people still continue to come because there are very few legal, managed, authorized ways for them to do so.
Tell me a little about what you're seeing then in terms of the border guards and, you know, the violence that you describe, the violent methods that you describe there.
I would say probably one of the worst aspects of EU border control is its arrangement with Libya. Simply put, for many people, especially those coming from sub-Saharan Africa, East Africa, but many other nationalities too, they will use Libya as a disembarkation point to get boats to Italy, Greece, and so on. And the EU has trained and financed what is referred to as the Libyan Coast Guard, which is effectively a group of militia to patrol that coast. And that means when they apprehend a migrant boat, they will drag it back to Libya. The migrants are then roughed up, put into detention centers where the most unspeakable horrors are visited upon them, including, you know, sexual abuse, also extortion. Many of the people who are patrolling the coast, the so-called Libyan Coast Guard, are also deeply involved in the smuggling of migrants as well. That's something that even European Commission officials have admitted, as well as very other reputable human rights groups. Frontex actually provides aerial assistance to the Libyan Coast Guard. So it communicates to the Libyans that boats are crossing to Europe. The Libyans then come and take these people back to be horrifically abused. There are other instances where you have Greek Coast Guard pushing back boats to Turkey, sometimes even actually abducting migrants once they've arrived on the Greek islands and pushing them back out in very flimsy vessels. As a result, some have died. You have on the eastern side of the European Union, Poland. There's a vast forest that covers Poland and neighboring Belarus. Polish border guards apprehend migrants in this forest, sometimes dump them back into the forest where many have frozen to death. Sometimes they push them back to Belarus, which is a dictatorship with extremely brutal border guards. There are many examples of this. Croatia is on record of having tortured migrants and pushed them illegally over the border into Bosnia, where a humanitarian crisis has been running for several years. This happens on a daily basis. It means that migrants and refugees will do anything they can to avoid meeting the authorities. Mm-hmm. And that includes even once they finally arrive in their destination country, because what a lot of these hostile policies do, they don't necessarily deter people from coming. What they do is deter people from actually integrating once they've arrived. They may not even claim asylum. They may decide to stay in the shadow economy. And then we may never really know truly how many people are coming. And their integration outcomes are very poor because they are effectively criminalized.
So what do you make then when you hear Frontex and when you hear Ursula von der Leyen and their characterization of this migration issue as a success?
It very much depends on how they're defining success. I mean, doing an annual count of numbers doesn't really prove much at all. Migration trends are only really identifiable over many years. It's true that obviously the situation on the ground in Syria, which was a major driver of refugees into Europe, obviously the situation there has changed. It's a bit early to say, though, how safe it may remain. It's obviously different than the height of 2016, where cities were being carpet bombed. But also, many people have since made their lives in Europe. They might not be necessarily going back so quickly. I think a lot of migrants and refugees are now completely dependent on smugglers. That's because of European border control and increasingly hostile policies in the countries of destination. What the European Union have done with its failure to actually set up at scale pathways for migrants who actually want to come and work, because actually a lot of people are appearing in the asylum system who actually don't need asylum. They just consider it the only way that they can stay in the country, but actually what they want to do is work. So pathways for labor, also humanitarian pathways too. Last year, the EU resettled in the low thousands. I mean, this is not a serious number. So people who have a desperate need to come to the European Union to reunite with family, they are forced to use smugglers. So the Ursula von der Leyen may say that they're breaking the business model of smugglers, but in fact they're actually they maintain the market for it and mean that the entry points into the European Union are almost entirely controlled by smugglers, sometimes also traffickers too.
Valerie, I want to bring you in here. What Andrew has described there, and essentially EU complicity in brutality, and in we're going to say this is working, the numbers are down, while over here on the other right-hand side where you can't see, all manner of horrific things are happening to those people who are still making that journey and still paying a very heavy price financially and emotionally for doing so. Does that shock you?
Well, I mean, I've heard the stories all along, and particularly the stories coming out of Libya, where not only do they bring people back and imprison them in Libyan jails, but they then offer a ransom system where you've got to pay to get out again. And, you know, for the EU to even contemplate doing business with countries who are operating like this, I think we need to just step back a little bit, really, as you said there, as Andrew said, step back a little bit and realise that these are human beings. This is a humanitarian crisis, not of their making. I mean, they're coming with the most horrific stories. When we were out there, we were there for over a number of trips over 2 years, and we only stopped going because my husband became ill. But when you think of what they've left behind, I mean, these people have left their families behind. They know they'll never see them again. They've lost their homes. I remember one night or early one morning, a man came in from Syria and he had a little 9-year-old boy. And the 9-year-old boy, his face and his head was just cross-stitched with scars. And he'd come home from work. He worked in a dentist surgery. He wasn't a dentist. And came home and his wife was dead. The house had been bombed and his baby was dead. So he grabbed his 9-year-old son and just headed off into the unknown, made it to the Greek islands and did get through eventually. But, you know, how is that child ever going to have a normal existence, really? And that story, I mean, I could tell you hundreds of stories, but we haven't got the time.
As I'm sure Andrew could too in exactly, his experience.
Exactly. And some people do very, very well. Like, we followed a lot of people. But, you know, they're on the ground for about walking and getting lifts or whatever for about 5 months before they even reach Turkey. And then they're living on nothing, mostly around Bodrum, that kind of area, because it's so close to get over. And then you see the ferry going over and back, and of course they can't get on that. I would be seriously concerned about what happens to these people in the following years, how they ever settle. They're not getting the same welcome they got back then. I mean, it's 11 years since it really came home to people what was happening. And I don't know, because it's very hard to quantify the way people are being treated. And if it wasn't for Andrew doing something like this, I think we probably wouldn't know very much about the follow-up and how bad it's been for them.
Andrew, you know, attitudes to immigration right across Europe, and you know, we've seen it here in Ireland with protests against international protection centres. You know, it is increasingly becoming hostile, where there would have been maybe 10 years ago when we saw those horrific photographs of Alan, for example, on the beach lying dead face down in the sea. There was an empathy, there was a level of understanding. Isn't this horrific? Isn't the world a horrible place? We must try and help these people. That's kind of changed, particularly in the screaming public narrative. If there was one thing you wanted people to know about the migration crisis, what would it be?
I think if the same had happened to your listeners, as had happened to some of the people that I've met over the last 10 years, they would have probably done exactly the same. You do whatever you need to do in an emergency. And if there's no legal avenue for you to do it, you don't sit tight and wait to be attacked or imprisoned. You get out of there. Now, that's not the case for everyone who appears in asylum systems across Europe, of course. And we should be honest about that. But as I've mentioned, there are very few ways if you are in need of humanitarian protection or if you want to work in Europe, there are very few ways for you to do so. European Union does not provide nearly enough, especially if we talk about demographic changes in countries in Europe, aging populations, the labor market demands more people. We will need to source those from other countries. But rather than facilitating that in a managed, legal, orderly way, we keep being shocked by people turning up in this higgledy-piggledy, chaotic fashion where they spend so much money on smugglers that they could otherwise use for their new life in their countries, which, by the way, they may not want to stay in for the rest of their life. Many people work for a year or two, or, for example, they may seek refuge in a country. The situation in their home country, like Syria, might change, and people do go back if they can, if they want to. So this is being constantly portrayed as a forever war, increasingly hysterical narratives. It's because the system has been built to create chaos. We haven't tried a managed system apart from, for example, with Ukrainian refugees who were actually given a choice about where they could go in Europe. They were allowed to work. They were supported with their children in schools. It wasn't perfect, of course. There are still issues, but it was a night and day difference between treatment of almost any other refugee I've seen in Europe, and actually the sky didn't fall.
But Andrew, it has to be said, I think, as well, that where an empathy and a welcome existed in the early days of the Ukrainian war, attitudes on the ground among people have changed slightly there as well. Valerie, final question for you. In terms of the crackdown that we're being told is happening here in Ireland in relation to illegal migration and abuses of the system, we've seen a number of actions and plans from Justice Minister Jim O'Callaghan. What message would you want him to hear about the background to why these people are travelling or on the move and are seeking to come here?
Yeah. Sometimes you've got to make a distinction between economic migrants and people who are leaving for other reasons. Now, we cannot complain about economic migrants. We've been
the biggest probably nationality of economic migrants in history.
What I would like to see is that we look at these refugees as real people, which we are not doing. And one of the things that came through very strongly to me, you know, you went out there and you thought, oh, poor refugees, destitute people, blah, blah, blah. And then when you got to know these people, you realised they were just ordinary people like ourselves. I mean, I remember one day a couple came in with their two children and they were absolutely destitute. The woman had lost her shoes and, you know, it was really, really bad. She turned out to be a scientist. He was a dentist. And they had lost everything. They were Syrians. They'd lost everything. They'd been bombed and so on. Now, they were picked up by Norway. Norway was great at finding these sort of people and commandeering them. And they've now got a wonderful life, both practicing again as professionals in Norway. But like, there's people coming in who are shopkeepers, teachers, chefs, everything. Even the chefs who were in Kos were recruited by the Irish Guards to run the restaurant. So you've got to see beyond this pathetic person arriving destitute on a beach, maybe injured. You've got to see their whole life. Look into what they wear, what they are, what they've left behind. You know, another, just very briefly, a family. They tend to come in extended families from Syria, or they were at that stage anyway. And a family of 14 came in. Three women in their 30s, their husbands' children, walking from Syria to Turkey. It took them 5 months. And one of the girls, one of the mothers, had died giving birth. And all they could do was bury her at the side of the road, pick up her baby and continue on. So, you know, these are the sort of people that we're just writing off as statistics if we only look at the numbers.
Andrew, Valerie, thank you very much for joining us today. huge food for thought, I think, in this topic and this discussion. But that's it for the moment from the podcast for today. You can listen back, of course, to every episode of News Talk Daily on the Go Loud player. For now, though, from me, Tara Duggan. Have a good day.